So last time on the pod, we had Jeremy Hunt's take on the 10-year plan for the NHS. And this week, we have Alan Milburn. Alan was the Secretary of State for Health in 1999 to 2003 under the Blair government. And his tenure saw the NHS plan, but also record levels of investment in the National Health Service. Importantly, Alan also had a hand in writing and developing the current 10-year plan. So what does Alan think about the plan? The current zeitgeist at the moment is reform or die, isn't it? And I remember this rhetoric from before. You'll remember Last Chance Saloon and 24 Hours to Save the NHS. We've all seen the figures, the OBR and all the rest of it, and the fiscal squeeze. But it's a bit blood-curdling, isn't it? And it's not quite what Darcy said. And my worry is that if we amp up the disasterisation, then doesn't it just feed all the stuff swirling around in the Times, Telegraph and Spectator, the end of the NHS, rip it up kind of stuff?
No, I don't think that's the problem. The problem is that people haven't fully recognised that there are three things that are broken here. There's the operating model, which is broken because he can't continue to run this gigantic system in the way that it's been run, certainly over the last 15 or so years, which is a pretty centralized command and control system with 20-odd thousand people sitting at the headquarters of the National Health Service. I mean, seriously, that's the size of a town. Can't work like that, as we all know. When it was performing at its best, it was performing in a much more devolved and much more diverse operating model. And the business model is broken because we can't just keep lobbing more and more money into the NHS at the expense of other public services. At least one estimate suggests that post the latest spending review, we're moving towards 50% of everyday expenditure being on the NHS at a time when defence expenditure needs to rise, when social care expenditure needs to rise, when expenditure on infrastructure and so on needs to rise. So the law of supply just isn't working anymore, particularly if productivity isn't matching the increases in expenditure. And it isn't. We're in pretty anemic economic growth. Nobody is projecting that's going to turn around quickly. But the third and most important thing that's broken is the care model. And I guess what the 10-year plan tries to do is fundamentally change the care model to move from one that is, frankly, over-dependence on acute-based care, which we know is both expensive and intervenes too late, to one which gives people greater independence, which enables us to intervene earlier, and which allows us to get upstream of disease and ill health, which is what the National Health Service at its inception was supposed to be about. Unfortunately, as you know, exhortations to change the care model haven't really worked. What you've got to do is you've got to change the system of financial flows, you've got to change the architecture, and you've got to change, I think, the philosophy about what the care model is about. And the care model fundamentally should be about empowering the individual patient, citizen, to take greater control of their health. And I guess what's different this time round, because people say, oh, we've heard all this before, is that now we have the tools in the box to be able to do that through the genetics revolution and the data revolution. You've got to be candid with people about what is broken here. You've got to be careful, of course, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because no one, certainly in the government, is saying that the fundamental principles of the National Health Service, the value set on which it's based, with care being made available according to need and not ability to pay, nobody is saying that that is wrong. And indeed, it is more right and more relevant than ever in a world where the genomics revolution is going to challenge more private insurance-based care systems.
And in all the work for the 10-year plan, was there any plan B developed or mooted if progress didn't improve along certain lines in the next 5 years?
No, I think this is an all-in plan, and it's right that it should be so, not least because, you know, if we're candid about the last 15 or so years, what has been missing, many things have, but two things I would say is clarity in direction and hope for the future. And I hope what the plan provides is an answer to those two questions. So I think it's clear in terms of the destination where we're trying to get to with this and the reforms that are needed to make it happen. And I hope that it provides a sense of possibility and an island of optimism in what feels like a sea of pessimism sometimes about what it is possible for healthcare to do. I think what it is fair to say is that although it is a 10-year plan, in one sense, it's a sort of 3+7 plan. In other words, over the next 3 to 4 years, you've got to really deliver the stuff that needs to be delivered in terms of the basic fundamentals of what patients need and care about, access to primary care, access to A&E, shorter waiting lists, and so on. And the 3 years has also got to see the foundations being laid for the longer-term transformation, both digitally, genomically, in terms of the workforce, in terms of the architecture of the system. And then the further 7 years, probably post the next general election, really about driving those reforms even further and faster.
You mentioned optimism, but I can't leave this podcast without asking you about the decision that was made in March, the chainsaw decision about NHS England and Department of Health. And sure, everyone understands this needs to be leaned up, this needs to be not duplicative and all that. But it's the way that it was done has really demotivated a lot of people. So can you say anything about why that decision was just suddenly made in a way that now is probably demotivated some key assets in the system?
This always happens, Jennifer. You've been around this course a million times, and so do I. Change is not pain-free. Nobody but nobody that I hear anywhere across the system is saying that it is currently sustainable. In fact, that's one of the big changes, I would say, from when I was Secretary of State to when Wes was Secretary of State. 25 years later, there's a consensus that something has got to give this time. And that is right. And when you just take a big step back and look at it, I mean, it's faintly absurd, the number of people who sit in the centre.
I think even though people quite understand the need to cut back, it just seemed a menacing thing to do.
I don't think it's menacing at all. I think it is absolutely consistent with the operating model that Wes and the government wants to see, which is one that is much more delegated, much more devolved, much more diverse, which is much less run from the centre. And in order to do that, I'm afraid the centre just has to be smaller. If you remember, there was a one-word slogan for the election campaign. It was called change. And that's what all the government is doing, is enacting the promise that it made to the electorate, and it's getting on with change. We're already a year into the government, and so it needs to be delivering not just tangible changes that people can see, but as fundamentally the structural and reform changes that hopefully will make the system sustainable for a longer term.
Let's go on to the bulk of the 10-year plan. The big point that everyone's been making is the delivery plan and the some of the enablers still need to be built, don't they? Like the financial physiology incentives in the system and so on. So on that delivery side, given the realism of the money, what you think the next step is? Is it really the 3-7, as you say, you do the must-dos now, but see what you can possibly do within the financial envelope for executing this vision?
Well, I think what 3+7 isn't is deliver the hell out of the as-is and then post the next general election, sort of get on with the reforms, so to speak. That just isn't going to work, because to deliver the as is, you're going to have to do the reforms. So not least because, as you say, the fiscal position for the government and for the country is obviously an extremely difficult one. And yes, the NHS is a sort of net winner, of course, you know, alongside defence, but nobody's pretending that there's a huge bonanza here, particularly when you take pay pressures and staffing pressures into account. So we've got to drive much harder on what we get out for what is being put in. And that's obviously an uncomfortable message. And the good thing is there's a lot to go at. And I think the neighbourhood health piece is, of course, an extremely important piece. And that's partially about infrastructure. It's partially about ways of working, integrated teams. It's partially about what you incentivize. We need to move the financial incentives from driving more activity into hospital to driving more activity out of hospital and keeping people healthy and at home and in the community. But I think a lot of the prize in terms of a more value-based approach to NHS finances is going to come through digitalization and is going to come in time through the prediction and prevention revolution that we're in the foothills of. So if you take an area like outpatients, we're spending 25 billion quid a year on and outpatients. It's a pretty suboptimum system. It's full of sort of duplication, unnecessary attendances, people who don't show up at all. And, you know, the modelling that has been done for the plan suggests that a goodly proportion of that can simply be taken out. People can be sort of dealt with either through the NHS app or through neighbourhood healthcare, which is just more efficient and, frankly, more convenient for the individual.
On the neighbourhood health idea and prevention, there's a whole lot that can be done in healthcare outside of hospitals, right? What slightly worries me is that if there's a lot of autonomy in the system to develop this, which you want, you say you want because you don't want a one size fits all, quite a few places might kind of go off into the blue yonder on the wider side at a time when the NHS just really has to hunker down and do what it needs to do first. And just before I left to come here today, I just had a look at what Kaiser Permanente offers in this space. And it does offer preventive care, which looks very healthcare, like, you know, vaccinations and stopping smoking and all that kind of stuff. On the wider sort of determinants, population health stuff, it does a bit, but it's quite circumscribed. So do you think there should be some stronger guide as to what this means?
I think here, although the distinction between primary and secondary prevention obviously isn't an absolutist one, the wider social determinants of ill health, poor housing, poor jobs, poor people, and all of that, and frankly, that broadly is outside the remit of the National Health Service, save for one exception, which is the NHS tends to be what is the biggest employer in the country, particularly in more disadvantaged communities, which obviously bear the brunt of health inequalities. So I think there is something that the NHS needs to think more about in the primary prevention space as an anchor institution and what it does to help address those issues, local employment for people, getting people out of economic inactivity and into work. But I think the general message in the plan is focus where you have locus. And the locus is around secondary prevention. That's where we've really got to up the game. And in my view, I think you're right. I think we'll need to be clear what the framework looks like. The new tool in the box, the thing I'm really excited about in the plan is this genomics population health service, you know, where eventually we will move to, you know, genetic testing at birth, and we will move to co-creating with families how you deal with risk factors that are identified, and we know it's not an exact science and so on, but it just opens up an entirely different vista for what healthcare can look like. So we do move away from the, if you like, the diagnose and treat model towards the predict and prevent model, which is something that everybody's always talked about. What we now have is the collision of genomic science and data analytics, which is actually going to allow us to do it, both at the individual level, precision medicine, and at the population level, population health management. This is where I think we want the neighbourhood health service to really, really focus.
Isn't there also another area on this risk prediction side where people like me, kind of well and healthy and low risk, can go off with the fairies about what our risk prediction is and start creating demands on the system? So you've created a whole load of people who are well with risk on their heads that they're now worried. So isn't that another area where we've really got to patrol the boundaries or else to be able to protect more basic care?
What we've got to do is make sure, to this guardrails point that you raise, that not only is it clear what the centre wants from the neighbourhood health service and from foundation trusts and so on and so forth, but we've also got to set up the architecture and the financial flows in such a way that it incentivizes those behaviours. And that's why I think the advent of, you know, this IHO model, underpinned by a very different set of financial reward and recognition mechanisms, is going to be so critically important. I mean, look, the thing I learned more than anything else in terms of the NHS and getting it pointed in the right direction is money talks. And I don't quantum, I mean what it is that you're recognizing and rewarding. So this is a big, big change that needs to be made to make sure that we are keeping people healthy and out of hospital and that organisations are incentivised to do so.
I was just rereading your essay, Alan, that you did with Nick Timmins for us in our book. And you were very clear of the distinction between the political engagement and reform to develop the system architecture, including regulation, financial flows, all the things you mentioned. Looking at then the reform side, the architecture, when I looked at this, having been around the houses or rather too many times, it seemed as if there was a bit of a mishmash in there. On the one hand, as you say, there's integrated health organisations. And on the other hand, there was a more statist kind of total police type of vibe going on in it and neighbourhood healthcare and so on. And I just wondered whether you can have a kind of architecture that has bits of both in it, or is that really just a recipe for one bit pulling one way and another?
you know, all too often we have this rather binary debate, don't we, between it's got to be collaboration or it's got to be competition. And most big ecosystems, whether in health or in other walks of life, they have a combination of both, and you need both. So the plan is very clear, isn't it, about one really big change, which is that we've got to stop viewing the healthcare system in this country as being about a single institution that we happen to call the National Health Service, and instead see it as being an ecosystem of very different providers, from telcos, techcos, you know, of course, private sector providers at the margins, the public sector. And that's what it is. And the role of the center, by the way, back to that sort of thorny question, has got to be both to manage and convene that ecosystem rather than to direct or run a single institution. So, and I think that is the genius of the modern world. We have so many tools available to us if we're prepared to leverage them.
That's quite a sophisticated architecture that's going to be needed. And that takes time. And there's a sort of outline of it in the 10-year plan and presumably more to be filled in. But that's
what the 10-year plan, it is what it says on the tin. And you're right. There's both a capability and a capacity question. It's a very, very fair question. And one of the sort of tragedies, I think, over the last sort of decade is a lot of the sort of pipeline of talent, particularly at that sort of mid-tier level, I'd say, you know, of regional, sub-regional, has been wiped out, you know, because all of that architecture was taken out. Then Simon found a way of surreptitiously putting it back in. So we've got to rebuild quite a lot of capabilities and capacity. And we know that the analytical capability, for example, on the commissioning side is nowhere near where it should be. Some are doing it well. Some parts of the country are doing it well. Some ICBs have really begun to get to grips with this. But the majority are in absolutely the foothills. So this is going to be a muscle that is going to have to be built over time. And I guess without taking too much solace in a sort of decade-long transformation, that is the beauty of having a 10-year runway, that you can afford to say, actually, there are some things that are going to take time to build. You know, we know where we want to get to, and it will evolve over time.
Given that speed is needed and given that hope is needed, like, can something work fast that shows you hope and optimism? What you said in your essay, it's quite colourful language. If politicians got out of the way, F all would happen, you said. So in true Milburn style, are you also planning to have demo sites where there are vanguard areas, I don't know, that are the most mature sites where all the conditions look as right to really push some of this forwards to at least show that it is possible? I didn't see that in the 168 pages, but I might have missed it.
I think so. I mean, I think as with all of these things, I mean, look, this is a gigantic sort of ecosystem, isn't it? Just the NHS, never mind the broader health ecosystem. So, you know, it employs 1.6 million people and its budget is the size of Portugal. So it's a country. And so some things you're going to want to make universal as quickly as possible. So the NHS app would be a case in point. Let's build out the functionality in such a way year by year that that's available everywhere. And then there are going to be parts of the country, and we've touched on IHOs. IHOs, in the first instance, are not going to be everywhere. There are going to be a few places where we think the performance and the people in terms of leadership are there to be able to manage a whole population health system. So, of course, that's going to be a few places. Neighborhood health, we want to make sure is rolled out across the whole country. But as you read from the plan, one of the very strong emphases is about ensuring that areas of disadvantage where the health inequalities are most acute become priorities. These areas become priorities for the new infrastructure that needs to be established. And I think on social equity grounds, that is the right thing to do.
So I guess that's my last question, which is approaching the next election. There has to be some kind of convincing narrative, particularly if enough change hasn't happened. Hopefully it has. The ground is warm, right? The public want that NHS, at least at the moment. That be the pitch, do you think?
What we can't do is go into the next election. Government couldn't go into the next election saying, you trusted us, we've delivered, everything's fine. I mean, that is just not going to be the position. But I think on the sort of core deliverables, so to speak, we have to deliver on the waiting list. It's absurd that you've got 7 million people sitting there, you know, many of them in pain and distress. And it's a real erosion of confidence. You can track the confidence graph and the waiting list graph, and the correlation is absolute. So, of course, we've got to deliver on that. We've got to get you know, the madness of the 8 a.m. scramble to get to see a GP, not in every part of the country, but, you know, in many parts of the country, you know, we've got to get that ended. So on the basic things that people see, often people, Jennifer, are judging both the performance of public services, including the NHS, and the overall state of the country, whether it's a perfect position, but whether it's moving in the right direction or the wrong direction. And I think people concluded at the last general election that the NHS and the country was moving on the wrong direction. By the time of the next election, the conclusion has got to be that it's moving in the right direction, both for the NHS and for the country as a whole.
Thank you so much to Alan for those insights. Do join us next time, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast for more in future. And if you've got time, also please do give us a rating, which will really help as well. Meantime, thank you very much to my colleagues, Sean and Leo at the Health Foundation, to Paddy and his team at Malt Productions, and it's goodbye from me, Jennifer Dixon.